I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio in Portland, where the time is now 9:02, and that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. We call ourselves moles because we work underground to explore the hidden roots of the social order we live in, and of which the mass media shows us only the glossy, manufactured surfaces, obscuring the machinery of deception and exploitation which keeps us enslaved to an unjust world order. The old mole was Karl Marx's figure for the revolution that works unnoticed underground and pops up into world affairs at unexpected moments to set the world on a radically new course. Of course, the unexpected can take many different forms, and certainly the election of Donald Trump was not generally expected, and yet it should not have been surprising. Neoliberal capitalism was failing all but the well-to-do, and in the absence of a visible and well-organized left, many people turned to what seemed the only alternative. They perhaps did not realize they were only getting a more virulent form of capitalism, one that begins to evoke the terrible word fascism. Here on the Old Mole, we try to get to the hidden roots of things. What is the root of fascism? Well, let's hear what the great German playwright Bertolt Brecht had to say about it in 1935, when fascism had come to power in his country. Fascism is a historic phase of capitalism. In this sense, it is something new and at the same time old. In fascist countries, capitalism continues to exist, but only in the form of fascism. And fascism can be combated as capitalism alone, as the nakedest, most shameless, most oppressive, and most treacherous form of capitalism. But how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? What will be the practical results of such truth? Those who are against fascism without being against capitalism, who lament over the barbarism that comes out of barbarism, are like people who wish to eat their veal without slaughtering the calf. They are willing to eat the calf, but they dislike the sight of blood. They are easily satisfied as long as the butcher washes his hands before weighing the meat. They are not against the property relations which engender barbarism. They are only against barbarism itself. They raise their voices against barbarism, and they do so in countries where precisely the same property relations prevail, but where the butchers wash their hands before weighing the meat. That's from an essay by Bertolt Brecht, and we'll link to it on the webpage for today's show, which will be available in a day or two at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. And you'll be able to hear any part of this show or other shows that you might have missed, or recommend it to your friends. Well, we'll be hearing a discussion in a few minutes about how much the word fascism fits or fails to fit the political leadership of the U.S. today. Bill Resnick will be talking with Bill Smaldone, a historian who studies fascism and socialism in 20th century Germany. Also on the show, in honor of Black History Month, our book mole Larry Bolden will be here to talk about Nella Larsen's novel Quicksand. Nella Larsen was a writer active in the Harlem Renaissance in the late 1920s. Now, because the Old Mole aims not only to understand the world, but also to change it, and we believe that our listeners share this aim, we're now featuring the Old Mole Action Calendar, a rundown of local events where you can go to make a difference. Here are a few opportunities to get involved coming up in the next week. Tomorrow, Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can get an insider's view of Inauguration Day protests, the Women's March on Washington, and the Portland Women's March. Then learn about next steps for activists, including opportunities to volunteer with Planned Parenthood, the Portland NAACP, Portland Women's March, or Let's Talk. This event is called Race Talks, Joining the Social Justice Movement, and it's at the Kennedy School, 5736 Northeast 33rd Avenue. Among the speakers is KBOO's Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland NAACP. That's Tuesday at 7. On Wednesday, February 15th, there will be a vigil at Pioneer Square from 5 to 6 p.m. called From the U.S. to Palestine, Together in Resistance. The vigil stands against the Trump agenda, From the U.S. to Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will be visiting Donald Trump. We will stand to say no to racism and Islamophobia here and from the Israeli government. No to David Friedman as U.S. ambassador. No to moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in violation of international law. That's on Wednesday, February 15th at Pioneer Square, 5 to 6. On Saturday from 2 to 4, there will be a hands-on training in community defense. What is community defense? Successful examples of community defense, and how to identify and organize your community against threats and challenges to your safety and well-being. This is at the SEIU Hall at 6401 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. For more information, email pdxactnow@gmail.com. Now again, that's on Saturday from 2 to 4. I'll have a couple more events to tell you about later in the show. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a book written by an African-American woman who was part of the Harlem Renaissance in the early part of the last century. But first, we want to tell you about another way you can support a voice of sanity and justice in our times, and that's by supporting KBOO. Now, here on The Old Mole is Larry Bolden, The Old Mole's resident book reviewer, to tell us about a book appropriate for Black History Month. Larry.
Good morning. Today, in honor of Black History Month, I want to talk to you about an author I suspect most of you, even you avid readers, have not heard of, Nella Larsen, and her short but powerful novel, Quicksand. Associated historically with the number of artists grouped together as the Harlem Renaissance, I suspect that this novel made a lot of people, both people of color and white, quite uncomfortable. The title is singularly appropriate. For Helga Crane, the heroine of the novel, saw her life and the lives of many, perhaps most, blacks, as lives caught and slowly sinking into quicksand, lives in which even the struggle to get out, get ahead, get going, were destined to pull people down, snaring and suffocating them mentally and spiritually. Helga has a Danish mother and an African-American father, and from early on feels that she belongs nowhere. The reader picks up her life when she is 22 and teaching at a well-respected Negro school. She's engaged to another teacher and thought of highly by the school's president, but she's profoundly unhappy and thinking of leaving her position. She had that afternoon, quote, had to listen to the banal and the patronizing and even insulting remarks of one of the renowned white preachers of the state, close quote. And that speech, along with her daily routines, have brought her close to a decision to resign from her post. Quoting from the book, the preacher that she is referring to, this was, he had told them with obvious sectional pride, the finest school for Negroes anywhere in the country, North or South. In fact, it was better even than a great many schools for white children. And he had dared any Northerner to come South and, after looking at this great institution, to say that the Southerner mistreated the Negro. And he said that if Negroes all would only take a leaf out of the book of Naxos and conduct themselves in the manner of Naxos products, there would be no race problem, because Naxos Negroes knew what was expected of them. They had good sense and they had good taste. They knew enough to stay in their place, and that, said the preacher, showed good taste. Close quote. Helga's answer to this is no forever. And though she has very little money or prospects, she decides to leave the school and her fiancé in spite of the president's attempts to keep her there, telling her she is just the sort of person the school needs. Her fiancé, who feels fortunate to have a position in the school, remains, and Helga trains north to make a living in whatever way she can. She is frankly and deeply confused by the whole issue of color. Quoting again from the book, for the hundredth time she marveled at the gradations within the oppressed, disoppressed race of hers. A dozen shades slide by. There was sooty black, shiny black, taupe, mahogany, bronze, copper, gold, orange, yellow peach, ivory, pinky white, pastry white. There was yellow hair, brown hair, black hair, straight hair, straightened hair, curly hair, crinkly hair, woolly hair. She saw black eyes in white faces, brown eyes in yellow faces, gray eyes in brown faces, blue eyes in tan faces, close quote. Of course, life in the North is no better. Besides the meaningless service job she has to accept, she also has to deal with men who want to save her. Finally, through happenstance, she finds a way to go to Denmark, and for a while things seem much better. Living there with an aunt, she is more than accepted into the community, but as a kind of exotic novelty. She's even courted by a famous artist who expects her to swoon when he offers marriage. Quoting Helga, "But you see, Herr Olsen, I'm not for sale. Not to you, not to any white man. I don't at all care to be owned, even by you." Close quote. Finally, surprising even herself, she returns to America, though she dreads it. Without telling too much of the story, I will tell you that she finally goes through an existential crisis and for a short time decides that religion is the answer for her. She marries a preacher, has children, and is soon engulfed in that life of mothering, though she very soon loses respect for the adored by others preacher. No happy endings here. After an illness that almost kills her and with a dawning awareness that religion is not the answer, that she must find a better, more rebellious way, quote, "Hardly has she left her bed and become able to walk again without pain, hardly had the children returned from the homes of the neighbors when she began to have her fifth child," close quote. Yes, this is a sad little book, but I think a profound one. I've been talking about Nella Larsen's novel, Quicksand. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And thanks, Larry. Well, Larry's reviews are one of the many excellent reasons for supporting KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, here is Bill Resnick to talk with Bill Smaldone about fascism.
Bill Smaldone, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill.
Bill Smaldone teaches history at the Willamette University, his specialty, Germany in the 20th century. He writes a lot, including a book, Confronting Hitler, and also European Socialist, A Concise History. Bill has served 4 years as a radical on the Salem City Council. He also co-founded Radio KMUZ, a new KBOO-like station in Salem, and he's on the editorial board of the Salem Weekly, an alternative paper. Bill, our president, Donald Trump, last week, he picked a fight with the U.S. judiciary, and it's not his first attack on them. In his campaign, he attacked a federal judge presiding over a case. The case alleged Trump University was a fraud. Trump attacked the judge for being Mexican, biased against him, and unfit to rule in the case. Ultimately, Trump gave up and settled the case for millions of dollars. It was a fraud. Last week, he attacked the courts again, though, much more consequential, for ruling that his executive order that amounted to a ban on Muslims coming to this country was unconstitutional and it was enjoined. In appealing the injunction, Trump and his lawyers responded that he and his men had superior knowledge of matters of national security and threats to this country, and the judges are barred from taking cases related to national security. Basically, he was arguing that he should be crowned emperor on national security. Well, he lost that one on appeal, and then he tweeted, "Just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system." And then he ended it, "People pouring in. Bad." As Paul Krugman pointed out, the really striking thing about Mr. Trump's Twitter tirade was his palpable eagerness to see an attack on America, which would show everyone the folly of constraining his power. Bill, that was ominously reminiscent of Hitler's rise to power. Tell us about how Hitler wiped out his opposition, his battles, in fact, in the beginning with opposition in the Bundestag, that's the German parliament, fight with judiciaries, all of them impeding him for a while, and then came the Reichstag fire. Give us the history.
Right. Well, let me just say that normally I tend to play down talk of fascism in the United States. I mean, I've been teaching for a long time now, and I'm very cautious in using the word fascist whenever people have accused American politicians of behaving in a fascist-like manner. But with this current regime, I'm finding that the use of the term fascist is more and more apt, and I don't hesitate to use it when referring to Trump or people like Mr. Bannon in his circle. I think that what Trump tried to do during his campaign was to not only delegitimize Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, but also to delegitimize the state. And he tried to show that the American democratic system was broken, and that only he, the strong man, was capable of fixing it. And in fact, he said that in many of his speeches, that only he could do it. Well, those are pretty ominous assertions. Since we have a system of government, you know, with three branches, and there should be lots of people involved and not just him. So now that he's in power, he's just continuing in that vein, and he aims to delegitimize any institution or any individual who disagrees with him. And so now that certain judges in certain matters have come out and made decisions against him, in particular on immigration, his goal is to delegitimize them and blow up the system. And he wants to show that only he can resolve our problems. So these judges then are to be targeted by him. And when he makes a claim asserting that if something happens, the judges are to blame, this is very reminiscent of Adolf Hitler's efforts in February of 1933, so in the month after he was appointed to the chancellorship, to show that a state of emergency was necessary. And the Reichstag fire that you mentioned was the pretext that he was able to use to basically abrogate the Constitution, set the police on all of his political enemies, and set the stage, therefore, for his party to dominate the legislature completely and allow him then to assert sole power. So I don't know if Trump is going to do all those latter things, but he certainly is intimating that in some of his statements.
Yeah, explain the Reichstag. Why was that such a...
The Reichstag was built in the 19th century after the creation of the unified German state in 1871. And the fire in 1933 symbolized in the minds of many the destruction of the Weimar Republic that had been created after the First World War and that was based on parliamentary democracy. And when that building burned, Adolf Hitler was able to pose as the defender of the political order, and he was able to assert that unless he had emergency authority, then Germany would slip into chaos and would become vulnerable to a Bolshevik seizure of power. And he then was able to use the emergency powers that the president granted him, because he was the prime minister and Hindenburg was the president. President Hindenburg had the right or the power to grant his prime minister emergency authority in certain situations. And Adolf Hitler used this emergency power to crush the communists, to also begin to round up social democrats or socialists, and to threaten all the other political groups in the country. Basically, it set Germany on the road to a one-party state that was achieved within about 5 months.
And he went after the media as well, the way Trump is in some ways, and closed down
Correct. All
papers, newspapers. There was a very vigorous press that opposed him and vigorous political parties on the left who opposed them.
That's correct, but he didn't do it all at once. And that you have to remember that. It took months. He did it using a combination of means. Some newspapers, like the Communist Party newspapers, were simply shut down. And later on, the Social Democratic Party newspapers were shut down when the party itself was abolished. Other newspapers that were not party-affiliated newspapers were heavily censored. And over time, they were effectively bought out by the Nazi Party or by the German state. And so it was a combination of censorship, buying out, and the use of a ban that over time allowed the Nazis to bring all of the newspapers into line. The term the Germans used was the Gleichschaltung, which means effectively to bring things into line, to Nazify them. And that took some time.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bill Smaldone. He's a scholar of German history. He's also an activist in Salem, was on the city council for a while, and now he's a co-founder of KMUZ, which is a cable-like station in Salem. We just discussed how Hitler seized power through conjuring up a national emergency, basically getting rid of parliament and getting rid of the rule of law, also neutering the judiciary, smashing critical media. Bill, one thing we didn't talk about is the Reichstag fire. It was blamed on an anarchist who had been a communist party member But it seems quite likely, and a lot of people have found evidence that, in fact, it was the Nazis themselves who either used this guy or, in fact, just did it themselves. And
right. Well, many books have been published on that subject, and it still has not really been clarified. The main point, though, that everybody should understand is that the Nazis used the fire as a pretext. Whether van der Lubbe set the fire himself, whether he was working on behalf of anybody else, whether the Nazis put him up to it, no one really knows, or it hasn't been settled.
Yeah.
But the main point here is that they used the fire as a pretext. The other thing that we should say here is that the Nazis used the pseudo-legal road to power. Everybody should remember that. They used democratic means to destroy the democratic state. So Hitler was extremely skillful at manipulating elections and manipulating plebiscites or public referenda to secure legitimacy through the popular vote or through votes in the Reichstag. So, for example, when he had intimidated all the other parties in March of 1933, there was a Reichstag session in which all the parties, with the exception of the Social Democrats, voted to give him sweeping powers for 4 years. So they passed what was called an enabling act. So they used a kind of democratic mechanism, something we would associate with parliamentary democracy, to essentially vote away the power of the parliament, hand it over to this strongman. It'll be interesting to see what Trump tries to do now. He will have to do some legislating. He can't do everything through a presidential decree. He will have to do some legislating. And it will be interesting to see how he tries to manipulate both houses of the Congress. We're not in the same situation as Germany was in 1933. We're not in an economic crisis in the same way. The situations are not easily comparable. But nonetheless, many of the methods he uses, this effort to delegitimize the institutions of the democratic order, that's perfectly in keeping with what fascists did in Germany, also in Italy. And it'll be interesting to see how Trump continues to try to do that and to aggrandize his own power.
Bill, Hitler was able, in fact, to kill or neutralize and petrify people. There was one condition of doing it, that is, he had to control the men with the guns and give them power. There was military and police, actually, some resistance to what Hitler was doing. How did he get rid of it?
Okay, first of all, we have to be very careful. We need to be very clear that in 1933 in Germany, the army was intensely nationalist and opposed the existence of the Republic. So many in the officer corps were very pleased with the Nazi seizure of power. They were anxious, however, because the Nazis also had an army of paramilitary fighters, their stormtroopers, which numbered in the many hundreds of thousands in 1933. And it was the stormtroopers who took the fight into the streets against the communists and the social democrats and basically unleashed a kind of civil war in the country while Hitler was manipulating the political system to secure his appointment. Once the appointment was secured, then the army was quite happy to see the democrats crushed and the union smashed, okay, and they were extremely excited about Hitler's proposals for rearmament, but they were very nervous about the stormtroopers. And so in 1934, Adolf Hitler organized the decapitation of the stormtrooper leadership. Basically, he had most of the SA leaders assassinated. In fact, his best friend, Ernst Röhm, who was the leader of the SA, Hitler had executed on his command. And what that did was it showed the army that as the country rearmed, it would be in charge of the rearmament, it would do the recruiting, it would create the officer corps, and the SA would not be folded into the army en masse and basically water down the power of the general staff. So that's how he won over the power of the army. In terms of the police were by and large a rather conservative institution in all of the different states. Some of the states were more social democratized than others. But one of the things that Hitler did when he took power was he appointed Göring to be in charge of the Prussian police. Göring was his second in command, and the Prussian police, by and large, obeyed orders. And so the left faced not only the army, but it faced the police forces, and it faced the Nazi paramilitary troops when Hitler was appointed prime minister. And the left, meaning the socialists and the labor unions, were quite fearful that if they undertook a civil war, they would lose, which is why they hesitated.
And that was part one of Bill Resnick's conversation with Bill Smaldone, who teaches history at Willamette University, specializing in 20th century Germany. Smaldone is the author of the book Confronting Hitler, which you can get for a $75 contribution to KBOO. Part two of this interview is about Trump's attempts to increase his powers based on threats of national security, and you can hear it next week here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Margaridge. Well, at the beginning of today's show, I quoted from Bertolt Brecht's 1935 article arguing that the seeds of fascism lie in capitalism itself, that only the elimination of capitalism can eliminate the threat of fascism. Turning to our own times, we can see how the neoliberal policies of the corporate state, in their unholy union of corporate and state power, have paved the way to the election of Donald Trump. What were these policies, or what are these policies? Neoliberalism favors privatization, fiscal austerity, deregulation, free trade, and reductions in government spending in order to increase the role of the private sector in the economy and society. As the private sector, dominated by massive concentrations of wealth in the hands of a tiny elite, increases its political power, the will of the people at large counts for less and less, and our interests are more and more subordinated to the interests of the elite. The result is stagnant or declining wages, less control over our working lives, the degradation of social services, a decaying infrastructure, environmental crisis, and a general demoralization. The only political movement that seemed to promise a new direction and to acknowledge what many people were feeling was the alt-right and the Trump campaign. But what exactly is it that gives the economic elite the power to control government and to ride roughshod over the needs of the people who elect them? One common answer is the role of money in politics, the massive amounts of money it takes to run for office, money mostly supplied by wealthy donors. But there is a more fundamental reason, and that is the power of the capital strike. If labor can bring production to a halt by going on strike, refusing to work, capital can go on strike by refusing to invest. To quote from a recent article on the Jacobin magazine website, capitalists routinely exert leverage over governments by withholding the resources, jobs, credit, goods, and services upon which society depends. The capital strike might take the form of layoffs, offshoring jobs and money, denying loans, or just a credible threat to do those things, along with a promise to relent once government delivers the desired policy changes. This same article, written by Kevin Young, Tarun Banerjee, and Michael Schwartz, goes on to illustrate how the capital strike operated during the Obama administration. Despite strong voter support for progressive changes, Obama's administration did little to challenge corporate power, inequality, militarism, and the growing climate catastrophe. Even the most timid efforts at reform were either defeated or watered down to appease entrenched interests. For example, Obama was elected with a clear mandate for strong financial reform, yet his administration did not prosecute even one person responsible for the crisis and took only weak measures to prevent the next one. Commentators often cite campaign donations, lobbying, Republican obstructionism, or Obama's own conservative inclinations to explain this record. But private control over investment is the root of the problem. The bank's decision to sustain disinvestment after the 2008 crash gave them the power to shape any legislation that sought to rein them in. During Obama's first year in office, the United States experienced the most damaging episode of disinvestment since World War II. Non-financial businesses were sitting on $2 trillion in capital, while banks kept another trillion. Companies were holding cash at rates not seen in half a century. A Bloomberg report found that companies that are spending have largely chosen to increase dividends and buy back stock rather than hire more workers, increase wages, or invest. This was not simply an automatic market response to low demand. Obama himself recognized that businesses were making a discretionary choice. His February 2011 speech at the Chamber of Commerce offered tax breaks and other government support for exports and innovation in return for domestic investment. Three initiatives to repair relations with corporate America represented Obama's side of the bargain. First, he renewed the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy and lowered corporate tax rates. Second, he continued his predecessor's deregulatory agenda, contrary to his campaign promises. And finally, he enhanced export opportunities and investment privileges through new trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, and later pursued the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. These policies did little to address unemployment and lower consumer demand, and they were not meant to do so. They were instead a response to unrelated corporate demands. End of that quote. In short, the social wealth of the world we all depend upon in order to produce what we need to live is privately owned by and managed in the interests of the wealthiest individuals and families. And this enables them to rule over us by insisting that if they don't get their way, they will not let us use this wealth to maintain our lives. Wealth which, after all, was extracted in the first place from our labor. The Jacobin article concludes that electing new politicians will not disrupt businesses' fundamental control over state policy. Only by targeting the substance of corporate power rather than its shadow, the government, can major progressive change be achieved and sustained. What is that substance? It is the private ownership of social wealth, that is, capital. Or, as the Jacobin writers say, ultimately, the capital strike teaches us that reform is not enough. Power over investment brings power over the political process. Eliminating the capital strike, therefore, requires the radical democratization of economic ownership and control in society, an end to private capital and illegitimate power in all its forms. That day is still a long way off. But building grassroots movements that focus our analysis, energy, and anger on the substance of the problem can contribute to that goal in a way that focusing on the shadow of elected government cannot. I've been drawing on When Capitalists Go on Strike by Kevin Young, Tarun Banerjee, and Michael Schwartz, and we'll link to it on the webpage for today's show. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, we're going to wrap up today's Old Mole Variety Hour with a few more items from the Old Mole Action Calendar. A week from today, Monday, February 20th, there will be a march sponsored by the Oregon AFL-CIO, SEIU, several other unions, and Portland Jobs with Justice. It's called We the People, Marching United in Resistance. It'll begin at noon in Directors Park, 815 Southwest Park and Park Avenue. Also on Monday, the 20th, there will be a Beyond Gas and Oil meeting and potluck at the Oregon Sierra Club on Southeast Ankeny Street. For more information or to volunteer, you can contact gregory.monahan at oregon.sierraclub.org. That's gregory.monahan at oregon.sierraclub.org. And also a special announcement, Old Mole Jan Hawkins' latest film is called Kuwepo, which means being there in Swahili, and it tells the stories of post-abortion providers in Kenya. The film will premiere in Portland on Saturday, February 18th, as part of the 40th Portland International Film Festival in Witzel Auditorium at 2:30 p.m. That's at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue. Well, that's going to conclude the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. So join us again next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground point of view. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and our engineer has been Patsy Kullberg.